I talk you into a little distraction first? She said, reaching up and kissing him on the mouth.
I guess so, he replied, dropping the keyboard on the floor. It will probably be good for me to clear my mind.
Nicole was in the middle of a beautiful dream. She was home again, at her villa in Beauvoir. Richard was sitting beside her on the couch in the living room and was holding her hand. Her father and daughter were opposite them in the soft chairs. Her dream was broken by Richard's insistent voice. When Nicole opened her eyes, her lover was standing over her, his voice crackling with excitement.
"Wait until you see this, darling," he said, extending a hand to pull her up. "It's fantastic! Somebody is still here!"
Nicole shook the dream from her mind and looked over at the black square where Richard was pointing.
"Can you believe it?" he said, jumping up and down. "There's no doubt about it. The military ship is still docked."
Only then did Nicole realize that she was looking at a picture of the outside of Rama. She blinked her eyes and listened to Richard's rambling explanation.
"Once I figured out the code for the enhancement parameters, almost every frame became clear. That set of pictures I showed you earlier must be the real-time output from hundreds of Rama's imaging sensors. And I think I have figured out how to access the other sensor databases as well."
Richard was exultant. He threw his arms around Nicole and lifted her off the ground. He hugged and kissed her and bounced around the room like a lunatic. When he finally calmed down a little, Nicole spent almost a full minute studying the image that was projected on the black square. It was definitely the Newton military ship. She could read the markings.
"So the science spacecraft has gone home," she commented to Richard.
"Yes," he answered. "As I expected. I was afraid they would both be gone and that after we swam across the sea, we would find ourselves still trapped, this time in a larger prison."
The same concern had bothered Nicole. She smiled at Richard.
"It's relatively straightforward then, isn't it? We swim across the cylindrical sea and walk over to the chairlift. Someone will be waiting for us at the top."
Nicole started packing her belongings. Richard, meanwhile, continued to flash new images on the screen.
"What are you doing now, darling?"
Nicole asked gently.
"I thought we were going to make our swim."
"I haven't made a full pass through the sensor list since I located the enhancement parameters," Richard replied. "I just want to make certain we're not missing anything critical. It will only take another hour or so."
Nicole stopped packing and sat down in front of the screen beside Richard. The pictures were indeed interesting. Some were exterior shots, but most were images of different regions inside Rama, including the underground layers. One magnificent photo was taken from the top of the large room where the hot spheres in their sponge webbing rested on the floor beneath the hanging lattices. Richard and Nicole watched the picture for a moment, hoping to see a black and gold octo-spider, but they detected no movement. They were near the end of the list when an image of the bottom third of the Alpha Stairway stunned them both. There, climbing down the stairs, were four human figures in spacesuits. Richard and Nicole watched the figures descend for 5 seconds and then exploded with joy.
"They're coming," Richard said, throwing his arms into the air. "We're going to be rescued."
Chapter 51 Escape Harness. Richard was becoming impatient. He and Nicole had been standing on the walls of New York for over an hour, scanning the skies for some sign of a helicopter.
"Where the hell are they?" he grumbled. "It only takes 15 minutes by rover from the bottom of Alpha Stairway to the Beta campsite."
"Maybe they're looking somewhere else," Nicole said encouragingly.
"That's ridiculous," Richard said. "Surely they would go to Beta first. And even if they couldn't repair the comm system, at least they'd find my last message. I said I was taking one of the motorboats to New York."
"They probably know that there's no place for a helicopter to land in the city. They may be coming across in a boat themselves."
"Without first seeing if they could spot us from the helicopter? That's unlikely."
Richard turned his eyes to the sea and searched for a sail.
A boat, my kingdom for a boat."
Nicole laughed, but Richard barely managed a little smile.
"Two men could assemble the sailboat in the supply hut at Beta in less than 30 minutes, he fretted. "Damn it, what's holding them up?"
In his frustration, Richard switched on the transmitter in his communicator.
"Now hear this, you guys. If you're anywhere near the cylindrical sea, identify yourselves. And then hurry your asses over here. We're standing on the wall and we're tired of waiting."
There was no response. Nicole sat down on the wall.
What are you doing? Richard asked.
I think you're worrying enough for both of us, she responded, and I'm tired of standing up and waving my arms. She stared across the cylindrical sea.
It would be so much easier, Nicole said wistfully, if we could just fly across ourselves.
Richard cocked his head to one side and looked at her.
What a great idea, he said several seconds later. Why didn't we think of it before?
He immediately sat down and started doing some calculations on his computer.
Cowards die many times before their deaths, he mumbled to himself. The valiant never taste of death but once.
Nicole watched her friend furiously pounding his keyboard.
What are you doing, dear? She inquired,
glancing over his shoulder at the computer monitor.
Three should be enough.
Richard looked up at the puzzled Nicole.
Do you want to hear the most outrageous plan in interplanetary history? He asked her.
Why not? She said with a doubtful smile.
We are going to build ourselves harnesses out of the lattice material, and the avians are going to fly us across the cylindrical sea.
Nicole stared at Richard for several seconds.
Assuming we can make the harnesses, she said skeptically, how do we talk the avians into doing their part?
We convince them it's in their own best interest, Richard replied. Or alternatively, we threaten them in some way. I don't know. You can work on that issue.
Nicole was incredulous.
Anyway, Richard continued, grabbing her hand and walking down the wall, it beats standing around here waiting for the helicopter or the boat.
5 hours later, there was still no sign of the rescue team. When they had finished making the harnesses, Richard had left Nicole at the wall and gone back to the white room to check through the sensor set again. He returned with the news that he thought he had seen the human figures in the vicinity of the Beta campsite, but that the resolution on that particular frame had been very poor. As they had agreed, Nicole had been calling every half hour on the communicator. There had been no response.
Richard, she said,
while he was programming some graphics on his computer,
why do you think the rescue team was using the stairway?
Who knows, he replied. Maybe the chairlift malfunctioned and there were no engineers left.
It seems strange to me, Nicole mused. Something about this is bothering me, she thought, but I don't dare share it with Richard until I can explain it.
He doesn't believe in intuition. Nicole glanced at her watch.
It's a good thing we rationed the melon. If the rescue team doesn't show up and this wild scheme doesn't work, we won't be swimming until next daylight.
Preliminary design complete, Richard stated emphatically. He waved to Nicole to join him. If you approve the line drawing, he said, pointing at the monitor in his hand, then I will proceed with the detailed graphics.
In the picture, three large avians, each with one line wrapped around its body, were flying in formation across a sea. Dangling underneath them, and attached by three lines, was a stick-figure human being sitting in a flimsy harness.
Looks good to me, said Nicole,
never thinking for a minute that such an event would actually happen.
I can't believe we're doing this, Nicole remarked,
pushing the plate to open the avian layer for the second time. Their first attempt to renew contact had resulted in the expected cold shoulder. This second time, it was Richard who shouted into the avian layer.
Listen to me, you avians, he growled in his fiercest voice. I need to talk to you, right now. Get up here on the double.
Nicole had to restrain a laugh. Richard began dropping black objects into the lair.
See? He said with a grin. I knew these damn things would be good for something.
Eventually, they could hear some activity at the bottom of the vertical corridor. The same pair of avians they had seen before flew up to the top of the lair and started screeching at Richard and Nicole. They did not even look at the monitor when Richard held it out for them. When they were finished screeching, the pair flew over the top of the tank sentinel and the cover closed again.
It's no use, Richard, Nicole said when he asked her to open the cover a third time. Even our friends are against us.
She paused before pressing the plate.
What are we going to do if they attack us?
They won't attack, Richard said,
indicating for Nicole to open the cover.
But just in case, I want you to stay over there. I will deal with our feathered friends.
There was jabbering from the lair as soon as the cover opened the third time. Richard immediately started shouting back and pitching black objects down the corridor. One of them hit the tank sentinel and prompted a small explosion, like a gunshot. The two familiar avians flew up to the opening and screamed at Richard. Three or four of their comrades were just behind. The noise was unbelievable. Richard did not back down. He kept yelling and pointing at the computer monitor. Finally, he was able to get their attention. The group of avians watched the graphic depiction of the flight across the sea. Richard then held up one of the harnesses in his left hand and started running the demonstration on his monitor again. Frantic conversation among the avians ensued. At the end, however, Richard sensed that he had lost. As a pair of the other avians flew over the top of the tank sentinel, Richard climbed down into the lair, onto the first ledge. "Hold it!" he shouted at the top of his lungs. The mate of the black velvet avian lunged forward, its threatening beak no more than a meter from Richard's face. The noise from all the screeching and jabbering was deafening. Richard was undaunted. Despite the avian protests, he descended to the second ledge. Now, he would not be able to escape if the cover started to close. Again, he held up the harness and pointed at the monitor. A chorus of screeches told him the response. Then, above the avian howl, he heard another sound, like a klaxon alarm announcing a fire drill at a school or hospital. All the avians immediately calmed down. They settled quietly on the ledges and stared down at the tank sentinel. The lair was strangely silent. After a few seconds, Richard heard the beating of wings, and moments later, a new avian flew into the vertical corridor. It rose slowly up to his level and hovered just opposite him. It had a grey velvet body and sharp grey eyes. Two thick rings of bright cherry red were wrapped around its neck. The creature studied Richard and landed on the ledge opposite him, across the corridor. The avian that had been in that spot scurried out of the way. When the grey velvet bird spoke, it was soft and very clear. After the speech was finished, the black velvet avian flew up beside the new arrival and apparently explained the furore. Several times the two avians stared across at Richard. The last time, thinking that perhaps their nodding heads were a cue, Richard displayed the graphic flight one more time and held up the harnesses. The bird with the cherry rings flew over beside him for a closer look. The creature made a sudden movement, frightening Richard, and he nearly fell off the ledge. What may have been avian laughter was silenced by a few words from the grey velvet leader, who then sat quite still, as if it were thinking, for over a minute. At length, the avian leader gestured towards Richard with one talon, opened its huge wings, and soared out through the opening into daylight. For several seconds, Richard did not move. The great creature rose up, up into the sky above the lair, and was soon followed by the two more familiar avians. Moments later, Nicole's head appeared in the opening. "Are you coming?" she asked. "I don't know how you did it, but it looks as if our friends are ready."
Chapter 52 Flight 302
Richard pulled the harness tight around Nicole's waist and buttocks.
"Your feet will dangle," he said, "and at first, when the lattice cord is stretching, you will have the feeling that you're falling."
"What if I hit the water?" Nicole asked.
"You have to trust the avians to fly high enough that you won't," Richard replied. "I think they're quite intelligent, especially the one with the red rings."
"Do you think it's the king?" Nicole asked,
adjusting the harness for comfort.
"Probably their equivalent," Richard answered. "He has made it clear from the beginning that he intends to fly in the middle of the formation."
Richard walked up the steep incline to the wall, carrying all three harness lines in his hands. The avians were sitting quietly together, staring out at the sea. They acquiesced as he tied the harness around their midsections, just behind the backs of the wings. Then they watched his computer monitor as he again showed them the graphics of the takeoff. The avians were to lift off together, slowly, pull the harness lines taut directly over Nicole's head, and then lift her straight up before flying north across the sea. He checked that the knots were secure and then returned to Nicole's side at the bottom of the incline. She was only about 5 meters from the water.
"If by some chance the avians do not return for me," Richard told her, "don't wait forever. Once you find the rescue team, assemble the sailboat and come across. I'll be down in the white room." He took a deep breath. "Be safe, my darling," he added. "Remember that I love you."
Nicole could tell from the pounding of her heart that the moment of takeoff had finally arrived. She kissed Richard slowly on the lips.
"And I love you,"
she murmured. When they broke their embrace, Richard waved at the avians on the wall. The grey velvet avian cautiously rose in the air, followed immediately by its two companions. They hovered in formation directly over Nicole. She felt the three lines pull tight and was momentarily lifted into the air. Seconds later, as the elastic cord began to stretch, Nicole was falling toward the ground again. The avians flew higher, heading out over the water, and Nicole felt as if she were a yo-yo, bouncing up and down as the cord would stretch and then contract with a jerk when the avians rose swiftly to a higher altitude. It was an exciting flight. She touched the water once, just barely, while she was still close to shore. She was temporarily frightened, but the avians lifted her quickly before anything more than her feet were wet. Once the lattice cord was at its full extension, the ride was fairly smooth. Nicole sat in her harness, her hands holding on to two of the three lines, her feet dangling below her about 8 meters from the tops of the waves. The middle of the sea was quite calm. About halfway across, Nicole saw two great dark figures swimming along beneath her, parallel to her course. She was certain they were shark bilots. She also detected two or three other species in the water, including one, long and skinny like an eel, that reared itself out of the sea and watched her fly by. Phew, Nicole thought, as she surveyed the water. I'm certainly glad that I didn't swim. The landing was easy. Nicole had been concerned that the avians might not realize there was a 50-meter cliff on the opposite side of the sea. She needn't have worried. As they approached landfall in the northern hemicylinder, the avians gently increased their altitude. Nicole was set down gingerly, about 10 meters from the edge. The huge birds landed close by. Nicole climbed out of her harness and walked over to the avians. She thanked them profusely and tried to pat them on the backs of their heads, but they jerked away from her touch. The creatures rested for several minutes and then, at a signal from their leader, they flew off across the sea toward New York. Nicole was surprised at the intensity of her emotions. She knelt down and kissed the ground. It was only then that she realized she had never really expected to escape safely from New York. For a moment, before she started searching for the rescue team with her binoculars, she reviewed everything that had happened to her since that fateful crossing in the ice mobile. "Before New York is a lifetime ago," she said to herself. "Now, everything has changed." Richard untied the harness from the avian leader and dropped it on the ground. All the birds were now free. The creature with the grey velvet body craned its neck around to see if Richard was finished. The rich cherry red of its rings was even clearer in the full daylight. Richard wondered about the rings and what they signified, knowing there was a high likelihood he would never see these magnificent aliens again. Nicole came over beside Richard. When he had landed, she had embraced him passionately. The avians had boldly stared, signaling their curiosity. They too, Nicole thought, must be wondering about us. The linguist in her imagined what it would be like actually to talk to an extraterrestrial species, to begin to understand how an altogether different intelligence might operate. "I wonder how we say goodbye and thank you," Richard was saying. "I don't know," Nicole replied, "but it would be nice." She stopped to watch the avian leader. It had called the other two creatures to come beside it, and the three birds were standing facing Richard and Nicole. On a signal, they all spread their wings to their full extent and formed into a circle. They turned around one full revolution and then fell back into a straight line facing the humans.
"Come on," Nicole said. "We can do that."
Nicole and Richard stood side by side, their arms outstretched, and faced their avian friends. Nicole then put her arms on Richard's shoulders and led him through a circular turn. Richard, who was sometimes not very graceful, stumbled once but managed to complete the movement. Nicole imagined that the avian leader was smiling when she and Richard straightened out after their revolution. The three avians took off seconds later. Higher and higher in the sky they rose, until they were at the limit of Nicole's vision. Then they flew south, across the sea, toward home.
"Good luck," Nicole whispered as they departed.
The rescue team was not in the vicinity of the Beta campsite. In fact, Richard and Nicole had not seen any sign of them during a 30-minute drive in the rover along the coast of the Cylindrical Sea.
"These guys must really be stupid,"
Richard groused. My message was in plain view there at Beta. Could it be that they haven't even come down this far yet?
It's less than 3 hours until dark, Nicole replied. They may have returned to the Newton already.
All right, then, to the hell with them, Richard said. Let's have a bite to eat, and then head for the chairlift.
Do you think we should save any of the melon?
Nicole asked a few minutes later, while they were eating. Richard gave her a puzzled glance.
Just in case, she added.
Just in case what? Richard rejoined. Even if we don't find that idiotic rescue bunch and must climb all the stairs ourselves, we'll still be out of here right after dark. Remember, we become weightless again at the top of the stairway.
Nicole smiled. I guess I'm naturally more cautious, she said.
She put several bites of melon back into her pack. They had driven 3/4 of the way toward the chairlift and the alpha stairway when they spotted the 4 human figures in spacesuits. It looked as if they were leaving the conglomeration of buildings that had been designated as the Raman Paris. The figures were walking in the opposite direction from the rover.
I told you the guys were idiots, Richard exclaimed. They don't even have the sense to take off their spacesuits. It must be a special team, sent up in the spare Newton vehicle just to find us and bring us back.
He steered the rover across the central plain in the direction of the humans. Richard and Nicole both started shouting when they were within 100 meters, but the men in the spacesuits continued their slow procession toward the west.
They probably can't hear us, Nicole offered.
They still have on their helmets and communication gear.
A frustrated Richard drove up to within 5 meters of the single-file line, stopped the rover, and jumped out in a hurry. He ran quickly around to the leader, shouting all the way.
Hey, guys, he yelled, we're here, behind you. All you have to do is turn around.
Richard stopped cold as he stared at the blank expression of the man in the lead. He recognized the face. Jesus, it was Norton. He shuddered involuntarily as a tingle ran down his spine. Richard barely jumped out of the way as the 4-man procession walked slowly past him. Numb from the shock, he quietly studied the other 3 faces, none of which changed expression as they marched past. They were 3 other cosmonauts from the Rama 1 crew. Nicole was at his side only seconds after the final figure passed him.
"What's the matter?" she said. "Why didn't they stop?"
The blood had all drained out of Richard's face.
"Darling, are you all right?"
"They're biots," Richard mumbled. "Goddamn human biots."
"What?"
Nicole replied, a streak of terror in her voice. She ran quickly to the head of the line and stared at the face behind the helmet glass. It was definitely Norton. Every feature of the face, even the color of the eyes and the slight mustache, was absolutely perfect. But the eyes didn't say anything. The motion of the body, too, now that she noticed it, seemed artificial. Each pair of steps was a repeated pattern. There were only slight variations from figure to figure. Richard is right, Nicole thought. These are human biots. They must have been made from the images, just like the toothpaste and the brush. A momentary panic swelled in her chest. But we don't need a rescue team, she told herself, calming her anxiety. The military ship is still docked at the top of the bowl. Richard was stunned by the discovery of the human biots. He sat in the rover for several minutes, unwilling to drive, asking questions of Nicole and himself that he could not possibly have answered.
"So what's going on here?"
he said, over and over again.
"Are all these biots based on real species, found somewhere in the universe? And why are they being fabricated in the first place?"
Before they drove over to the chairlift, Richard insisted that they both shoot many minutes of video footage of the human biots.
"The avians and octo-spiders are fascinating," he said, as he took a special close-up of Norton's leg motion. "But this tape will blow everyone away."
Nicole reminded him that it was less than 2 hours until dark, and that it still might be necessary for them to climb the stairway of the gods. Satisfied that he had recorded the bizarre procession for posterity, Richard slid into the driver's seat of the rover and headed toward the alpha stairway. There was no need to perform any tests to see if the chairlift was working properly. It was running when they drove up beside it. Richard jumped out of the rover and ran into the control room.
"Someone's coming down," he said, pointing up the lift.
"Or something," Nicole said grimly.
The 5-minute wait seemed like an eternity. At first, neither Richard nor Nicole said anything. Later, however, Richard suggested that maybe they should sit in the rover in case they needed to make a quick escape. Each of them trained binoculars on the long cable stretching upward to the heavens.
"It's a man," cried Nicole.
"It's General O'Toole," said Richard a few moments later. Indeed it was. General Michael Ryan O'Toole, American Air Force officer, was descending in the chairlift. He was still several hundred meters above Richard and Nicole, but had not yet seen them. He was busy studying with his binoculars the beauty of the alien landscape around him. General O'Toole had been preparing to leave Rama for the final time when, as he rode up in the chairlift, he had spotted what looked like 3 birds flying far to the south in the Rama sky. The general had decided to return to see if he could find those birds again. He was unprepared for the joyous greeting that awaited him when he reached the bottom of his ride.
Chapter 53 Trinity.
When Richard Wakefield had left the Newton to go back inside Rama, General O'Toole had been the last crew member to say goodbye. The general had waited patiently while the other cosmonauts had finished their conversations with Richard.
"You're really certain you want to do this?" Janos Tabori had said to his British friend. "You know the full committee is going to declare Rama off-limits within hours."
"By then," Richard had grinned at Janos, "I will be on my way to Beta. Technically, I will not have violated their order."
"That's bullshit,"
Admiral Heilmann had interjected tersely.
"Dr. Brown and I are in charge of this mission. We have both told you to stay on board the Newton."
"And I've told you several times," Richard said firmly, "that I left some personal items inside Rama that are very important to me. Besides, you know as well as I do that there's nothing for any of us here to do over the next couple of days. Once the abort decision is definitely made, all the major scheduling activities will be on the ground. We will be told when to undock and head for Earth."
"I will remind you one more time," Otto Heilmann had replied, "that I consider what you are doing an act of insubordination. When we return to Earth, I intend to prosecute to the fullest—"
"Save it, will you, Otto?" Richard interrupted. There was no rancor in his tone. He adjusted his spacesuit and started to put on his helmet. As always, Francesca was recording the scene on her video camera. She had been strangely silent since her private conversation with Richard an hour earlier. She seemed detached, as if her mind were somewhere else. General O'Toole walked up to Richard and extended his hand.
"We haven't spent much time together, Wakefield," he said, "but I've admired your work. Good luck in there. Don't take any unnecessary chances."
Richard had been surprised by the general's warm smile. He had expected the American military officer to try to talk him out of leaving.
"It's magnificent in Rama, General," Richard had said. "Like a combination of the Grand Canyon, the Alps, and the pyramids all at once."
"We've lost 4 crew members already," O'Toole replied. "I want to see you back here safe and sound. God bless you."
Richard finished shaking the general's hand, put on his helmet, and stepped across into the airlock. Moments later, when Wakefield was gone, Admiral Heilmann was critical of General O'Toole's behavior.
"I'm disappointed in you, Michael," he said. "From that warm send-off, the young man might have concluded that you actually approve of his action."
O'Toole faced the German admiral.
"Wakefield has courage, Otto," he said, "and conviction as well. He is not afraid of either the Ramans or the ISA disciplinary process. I admire that kind of self-confidence."
"Nonsense," Heilmann rejoined.
"Wakefield is a brash, arrogant schoolboy. You know what he left inside? A couple of those stupid Shakespearean robots. He just doesn't like taking orders. He wants to do what's uppermost on his own personal agenda."
"That makes him a lot like the rest of us," Francesca remarked.
The room was quiet for a moment.
"Richard is very smart," she said in a subdued tone. "He probably has reasons for going back into Rama that none of us understand."
"I just hope he comes back before dark, as he promised," Janos said. "I'm not certain I could stand to lose another friend."
The cosmonauts filed out of the atrium into the hallway.
"Where's Dr. Brown?"
Janos asked Francesca as he walked along beside her.
"He's with Yamanaka and Turgenev. They're reviewing possible crew assignments for the trip home. As short-handed as we are, a lot of cross-training will be necessary before we leave."
Francesca laughed.
He even asked me if I could be a backup navigation engineer. Can you imagine that?
Easily, Janos replied. You probably could learn any of the engineering assignments at this point.
Behind them, Heilman and O'Toole shuffled down the corridor. When they reached the hall leading to the private crew quarters, General O'Toole started to leave.
Just a minute, Otto Heilman said. I need to talk to you about something else. This damn Wakefield thing almost made it slip my mind. Can you come to my office for an hour or so?
Essentially, Otto Heilman said, pointing at the unscrambled cryptogram on the monitor, this is a major change to the Trinity procedure. It's not surprising. Now that we know much more about Rama, you would expect the deployment to be somewhat different.
But we never anticipated using all five weapons, O'Toole responded. The extra pair were only loaded on board in case of failures. That much megatonnage could vaporize Rama.
That's the intent, Heilman said. He sat back in his chair and smiled.
Just between us chickens, he said. I think there's a lot of pressure on the general staff down there. The feeling is that Rama's capabilities were vastly underrated initially.
But why do they want to put the two largest weapons in the ferry passageway? Surely one of the bombs would accomplish the desired result.
What if it didn't explode for some reason? There has to be a backup.
Heilman leaned forward eagerly on his desk.
I think this change to the procedure clearly defines the strategy. The two at the end will ensure that the structural integrity of the vehicle will be absolutely destroyed. That's essential to guarantee that it is impossible for Rama to maneuver again after the blast. The other three bombs are scattered around the interior to make certain that no part of Rama is safe. It's equally important that the explosions should result in enough velocity change that all the remaining pieces miss the Earth.
General O'Toole constructed a mental image of the giant spacecraft being annihilated by five nuclear bombs. It was not a pleasant picture. Once, 15 years before, he and 20 other members of the COG General Staff had flown into the South Pacific to watch a 100-kiloton weapon explode. The COG system engineering personnel had convinced the political leaders and the world press that one nuclear test was necessary every 20 years or so to ensure that all the old weapons would indeed fire in an emergency. O'Toole and his team had observed the demonstration, ostensibly to learn as much as possible about the effects of nuclear weapons. General O'Toole was deep in his memory, recalling the spine-tingling horror of that fireball rising in the peaceful South Pacific sky. He was not aware that Admiral Heilman had asked him a question.
"I'm sorry, Otto," he said. "I was thinking about something else."
"I had asked you how long you thought it might take to get approval for Trinity."
"You mean in our case?"
O'Toole said with disbelief.
"Of course," Heilman responded.
"I can't imagine it," O'Toole said quickly.
"The weapons were included in the mission manifest solely to guard against openly hostile actions by the Ramans. I even remember the baseline scenario, an unprovoked attack against the Earth by the alien spacecraft, using high-technology weapons beyond the capabilities of our defenses. The current situation is altogether different."
The German admiral studied his American colleague.
"No one ever envisioned the Rama spacecraft on a collision course with the Earth," Heilman said. "If it does not alter its trajectory, it will gouge an enormous hole in the surface and kick up such dust that the temperatures will drop all over the world for several years. At least, that's what the scientists say."
"But that's preposterous," O'Toole argued. "You heard all the discussion during the conference call. No rational person really believes that Rama will actually hit the Earth."
"Impact is only one of several disaster scenarios. What would you do if you were chief of staff? Destroying Rama now is a safe solution. Nobody loses."
Visibly shaken by the conversation, Michael O'Toole excused himself from the meeting with Admiral Heilman and headed for his room. For the first time in his entire association with the Newton mission, O'Toole thought that he might actually be ordered to use his RQ code to activate the weapons. Never before, never for a moment, had he considered that the bombs in the metal containers at the back of the military ship were anything more than a palliative for the fears of the civilian politicians. Sitting at the computer terminal in his room, the concerned O'Toole recalled the words of Armando Urbina, the Mexican peace activist who had advocated a total dismantling of the COG nuclear arsenal.
"As we have seen both at Rome and Damascus," Senior Urbina had said,
If the weapons exist, they can be used. Only if there are no weapons at all can we guarantee that human beings will never again suffer the horror of nuclear devastation.
Richard Wakefield did not return before the Raman nightfall. Since the communication station at Beta had been knocked out of commission by the hurricane, the Newton had monitored the breakup of the cylindrical sea and the onset of the windstorm through telemetry relayed by Beta before it was silenced. Richard had moved out of communications range when he was halfway across the central plain. His last transmission to Janos Taburi, who had volunteered to man the comlink, had been typically Wakefield. As the signal from inside Rama was fading, Janos, in a light-hearted tone, had asked Richard how he wanted to be remembered, to your fans, in case he was swallowed by the great galactic ghoul.
"Tell them that I loved Rama not wisely, but too well," Richard had shouted into his communicator.
"What's that?" Otto Hallman had puzzled. The Admiral had come looking for Janos to discuss a Newton engineering problem.
"He killed her,"
Janos had said, trying without success to lock up the signal again.
"Who killed? What are you talking about?"
"It's not important," Janos had answered, spinning around in his chair and floating into the air.
"Now, what can I do for you, Herr Admiral?"
Richard's failure to return was not considered serious until several hours after the following Raman dawn. The cosmonauts remaining on the Newton had convinced themselves the night before that Wakefield had become absorbed in some task. "Probably fixing the Beta Com station," Janos had offered. Had lost track of the time, and had decided not to take a solitary ride out in the dark. But when he didn't return in the morning, a feeling of gloom began to pervade the conversation of the crew.
"I don't know why we won't admit it,"
Irina Turgenev said suddenly, during a period of quiet at dinner time.
"Wakefield is not coming back either.
Whatever got Takagishi and Dejadan got him as well."
"That's ridiculous, Irina,"
Janos replied heatedly.
"Da,"
she remarked.
"That's what you've always said. Ever since the beginning when General Botsov was cut to pieces. Then it was an accident that the crab biot attacked Wilson. Cosmonaut Desjardins disappears down an alley."
"Coincidence," Janos shouted. "All coincidence."
"You're stupid, Janos,"
Irina shouted back.
"You trust everybody and everything. We should blow the damn thing to pieces before it does any more."
"Stop, stop, you two,"
David Brown said loudly as the two Soviet colleagues continued to argue.
"All right now," added General O'Toole. "We're all a little tense. There's no need for us to quarrel."
"Will anyone be going in to look for Richard?"
The emotional Janos asked no one in particular.
"Who would be crazy enough?"
Irina began to respond.
"No," interrupted Admiral Heilmann firmly.
"I told him that his visit was unauthorized, and that we would not come after him under any circumstances. Besides, Dr. Brown and the two pilots tell me that we can barely fly the two Newton ships home with the manpower remaining, and their analysis assumed Wakefield was with us. We cannot take any more risks."
There was a long and somber silence at the dinner table.
"I had planned to tell everyone when the meal was over,"
David Brown then said, standing up beside his chair.
"But it looks to me as if this group could use some good news now. An hour ago we received our orders. We're to depart from Earth 1-14 days, a little over a week from now. Between now and then, we will cross-train the personnel, rest for the voyage home, and make certain that all the Newton engineering systems are working properly."
Cosmonauts Turgenev, Yamanaka, and Sabatini all shouted their approval.
"If we're going to leave without returning to Rama," Janos inquired, "why are we waiting so long? Surely we can be well enough prepared in 3 or 4 days.
"As I understand it," Dr. Brown replied, "our two military colleagues have a special task that will occupy most of their time, and some of ours, for much of the next 3 days."
He glanced over at Otto Heilmann.
"Do you want to tell them?"
Admiral Heilmann stood up at his place.
"I need to discuss the details first with General O'Toole," he said in a ringing voice. "We'll explain it to everyone else in the morning."
O'Toole didn't need Otto Heilmann to show him the message that had been received only 20 minutes before. He knew what it said. In compliance with the procedure, there were only 3 words. Proceed with Trinity. Chapter 54. Once a Hero. Michael O'Toole could not sleep. He tossed and turned, switched on his favorite music, and repeated both the Hail Mary and Our Father litanies over and over. Nothing worked. He longed for a distraction, something that would make him forget his responsibilities and allow his soul some repose. Proceed with Trinity, he thought to himself at last, focusing on the true cause of his disquiet. What exactly did that mean? Use the teleoperator forklifts, open up the containers, pick up the weapons, they were about the size of refrigerators, check out the subsystems, put the bombs in a pod, carry them over to the Rama seal, ferry them to the heavy load elevator. And what else? He thought. One more thing. It wouldn't take much more than a minute at each weapon, but it was by far the most important. Each bomb had a redundant pair of tiny numerical keyboards on its side. He and Admiral Heilman each had to use the keyboards to input a special sequence of digits, an RQ code it was called, before the weapons could be activated. Without those codes, the bombs would remain absolutely dormant forever. The original debates over whether or not to include nuclear weapons in a limited Newton supply manifest had echoed through the corridors of COG military headquarters in Amsterdam for several weeks. The ensuing vote had been close. It was decided that the Newton would carry the nuclear weapons, but to allay widespread concerns, it was also decided to implement rigorous safety measures that would guard against their unwarranted use. During these same meetings, the COG military leadership avoided public outcry by placing a top-secret classification on the fact that the Newton was transporting nuclear bombs to its rendezvous with Rama. Not even the civilian members of the Newton crew had been told about the existence of the weapons. The secret working group on Trinity safety procedures had met 7 times at 4 different locations around the world prior to the Newton launch. To make the deployment process immune to untoward electronic inputs, manual action had been chosen as the method of activation for the nuclear weapons. Thus, neither a lunatic on the Earth nor a frightened cosmonaut on the Newton could trigger the process with a simple electronic command. The current COG chief of staff, a brilliant but passionless disciplinarian named Katsuo Norimoto, had expressed concern that without electronic command capability, the military was unduly dependent upon the humans selected for the mission. He had been persuaded, however, that it was far better to depend on the Newton military officers than to worry about a terrorist or fanatic somehow gaining possession of the activation code. But what if one of the Newton military officers were seized by panic? How could the system be protected against a unilateral act of nuclear warfare by a crew member? When all the discussions were completed, the resultant safety system was relatively simple. There would be 3 military officers in the crew. Each of them would have an RQ code known only to himself. Manual input of any 2 of the long numerical sequences would arm the nuclear devices. The system was thus protected against either a recalcitrant officer or a frightened one. It sounded like a foolproof system. But our current situation was never considered in the contingency analyses, O'Toole thought as he lay in his bed. In the event of any dangerous action, either military or civilian, each of us was supposed to designate an alternate to learn our code. But who would have thought that an appendectomy was dangerous? Valeri's RQ died with him. Which means the system now requires 2 for 2. O'Toole rolled over on his stomach and pressed his face against the pillow. He now clearly understood why he was still awake. If I don't input my code, those bombs cannot be used. He remembered a luncheon on the military ship with Valeri Bortsov and Otto Heilman during the leisurely cruise toward Rama. "It's a perfect set of checks and balances," the Soviet general had joked, "and probably played a role in our individual selections. Otto would pull the trigger at the slightest provocation, and you, Michael, would agonize over its morality even if your life were threatened. I'm the tiebreaker." "But you are dead," General O'Toole said to himself, "and we have been ordered to activate the bombs." He rose from the bed and walked over to his desk. As he had done all his life when facing a tough decision, O'Toole pulled a small electronic notebook from his pocket and made 2 short lists. One summarizing the reasons for following his orders to destroy Rama, and the other presenting arguments against it. He had no strictly logical reasons to oppose the destruction command. The giant vehicle was probably a lifeless machine, his 3 colleagues were almost certainly dead, and there was a non-trivial implied threat to the Earth. But still O'Toole hesitated. There was something about committing such a flagrantly hostile act that offended his sensibilities. He returned to his bed and rolled over on his back. "Dear God," he prayed, staring at the ceiling, "how can I possibly know what is right in this situation? Please, show me the way." Only 30 seconds after his morning alarm, Otto Heilmann heard a soft knock on his door. General O'Toole walked in moments later. The American was already dressed for the day.
"You're up early, Michael,"
Admiral Heilmann said, fumbling for his morning coffee that had been automatically heating for 5 minutes already.
"I wanted to talk to you," O'Toole said pleasantly.
He courteously waited for Heilmann to pick up his coffee packet.
"What is it?"
the Admiral asked.
"I want you to call off the meeting this morning."
"Why?"
Heilmann replied.
"We need some assistance from the rest of the crew, as you and I discussed last night. The longer we wait to get started, the more chance we will delay our departure."
"I'm not ready just yet," O'Toole said.
Admiral Heilmann's brow furrowed. He took a long sip from his coffee and studied his companion.
"I see," he said quietly.
"And what else is needed before you will be ready?"
"I want to talk to someone. General Narimoto, perhaps, to understand why we are destroying Rama. I know you and I talked about it yesterday, but I want to hear the reasons from the person giving the order."
"It is a military officer's duty to follow orders. Asking questions could be viewed as a disciplinary breach."
"I understand all that, Otto," O'Toole interrupted. "But this is not a battlefield situation. I am not refusing to comply with the order. I just want to be certain."
His voice trailed off, and O'Toole stared off in the distance.
"Certain of what?"
Heilmann asked. O'Toole took a deep breath.
"Certain that I'm doing the right thing."
A video conference with Norimoto was arranged, and the Newton crew meeting was delayed. Since it was the middle of the night in Amsterdam, it was some time before the encoded transmission could be translated and presented to the COG Chief of Staff. In his typical manner, General Norimoto then requested several more hours to prepare his response, so that he could obtain staff consensus on what he was going to say to O'Toole. The General and Admiral Heilmann were sitting together in the Newton Military Control Center when the transmission from Norimoto began. General Norimoto was dressed in his full military uniform. He did not smile when he greeted the Newton officers. He put on his glasses and read from a prepared text.
"General O'Toole, we have carefully reviewed the questions contained in your last transmission. All your concerns were included on the issues list that was discussed here on Earth before we reached the decision to proceed with the Trinity. Under the unique provisions contained in the ISA-COG operating protocols, you and the other Newton military personnel are temporarily part of my special staff. Therefore, I am your commanding officer. The message that was transmitted to you should be treated as an order."
General Norimoto managed just a glimmer of a smile.
"Nevertheless," he continued reading, "because of the significance of the action contained in your order, and your obvious concern about its repercussions, we have prepared 3 summary statements that should help you to understand our decision. 1. We do not know if Rama is hostile or friendly. We have no way of obtaining additional data to resolve the issue. 2. Rama is hurtling toward Earth. It might impact our home planet, take hostile action once it's in our neighborhood, or perform benign activities that we can't define. 3. By implementing Trinity when Rama is still 10 or more days away, we can guarantee the safety of the planet, regardless of Rama's intentions or future actions."
The general paused for the briefest of moments.
"That is all," he then concluded. "Proceed with Trinity."
The screen went blank.
"Are you satisfied?"
Admiral Heilmann asked.
"I guess so,"
O'Toole said with a sigh.
"I didn't hear anything new, but I shouldn't have expected anything else."
Admiral Heilmann looked at his watch.
"We've wasted almost an entire day," he said. "Should we have the crew meeting after dinner?"
"I'd rather not," O'Toole replied. "This episode has exhausted me, and I hardly slept at all last night. I'd prefer to wait until the morning."
"All right,"
Heilmann said after a pause. He stood up and put his arm on O'Toole's shoulder.
"We'll get started first thing after breakfast."
In the morning, General O'Toole did not attend the scheduled crew meeting. He phoned Heilman and asked the Admiral to proceed with the discussion without him. O'Toole's excuse was that he had a vicious stomach upset. He doubted if Admiral Heilman really believed his explanation, but it didn't really matter. O'Toole watched and listened to the meeting on the video monitor in his room, never interrupting or adding to the proceedings. None of the other cosmonauts seemed particularly surprised that the Newton was carrying a nuclear arsenal. Heilman did a thorough job of explaining what was to be done. He enlisted the help of Yamanaka and Taburi, as he and O'Toole had discussed, and outlined a sequence of events that would be complete with the weapons deployed inside Rama in 72 hours. That would leave the crew another 3 days to prepare for departure.
"When will the bombs detonate?" Yanis Taburi asked nervously after Admiral Heilman was finished.
"They will be set to explode 60 hours after our scheduled departure. According to the analytical models, we should be out of the debris field in 12 hours. But for safety, we have specified in our procedure that the weapons will not be exploded unless we are at least 24 hours away. If our departure is delayed because of some crisis, we can always overwrite the detonation time by electronic command."
"That's reassuring," Yanis remarked.
"Any more questions?" Heilman asked.
"Just one," Yanis said. "As long as we're inside Rama, putting these things in their proper locations, I assume that it's all right if we look around for our lost friends. In case they may be wandering."
"The timeline is very tight, Cosmonaut Taburi," the Admiral replied, "and the deployment itself inside the structure only takes a few hours. Unfortunately, due to our delays in starting the procedure, we will place the weapons in their designated positions during the time that Rama is dark."
"Great," O'Toole thought in his room. "That's something else that can be blamed on me." All in all, though, he felt that Admiral Heilman had handled the meeting very well. It was nice of Otto not to say anything about the code, O'Toole told himself. He probably figures I'll come around. And he's probably right. When O'Toole woke up from a short nap, it was past lunchtime, and he had a ravenous appetite. There was nobody in the dining room except Francesca Sabatini. She was finishing her coffee and studying some kind of engineering data on a nearby computer monitor.
"Feeling better, Michael?" she said when she saw him.
He nodded.
"What are you reading?" O'Toole asked.
"I'm looking at the executive software manual," Francesca replied. "David is very concerned that without Wakefield we won't even know if the Newton software is working properly or not. I'm learning how to read the self-test diagnostic output."
"Phew," O'Toole whistled. "That's pretty heavy for a journalist."
"It's not really that complicated," Francesca said with a laugh. "And it's extremely logical. Maybe in my next career I'll be an engineer."
O'Toole made himself a sandwich, picked up a package of milk, and joined Francesca at the table. She put a hand on his forearm.
"Speaking of next careers, Michael, have you given any thought to yours?"
He looked at her quizzically.
"What are you talking about?"
"I'm trapped in the usual professional dilemma, my dear friend. My duties as a journalist are in direct conflict with my feelings."
O'Toole stopped chewing.
"Heilman told you?"
She nodded.
"I'm not stupid, Michael. I would have found out sooner or later. And this is a big, big story. Maybe one of the biggest of the mission. Can't you see the trailer on the nightly news? American General refuses to follow order to destroy Rama. Tune in at 5.
The General became defensive.
"I haven't refused. The Trinity procedure does not call for me to input my code until after the weapons are out of the containers.
And ready for placement in the pods," Francesca finished, "which is about 18 hours from now. Tomorrow morning, as near as I can figure, I plan to be on hand to record the historic event."
She rose from the table.
"And Michael, in case you're wondering, I haven't mentioned your call to Norimoto in any of my reports. I may refer to your conversation with him in my memoirs, but I won't publish them for at least 5 years.
Francesca turned and looked directly into O'Toole's eyes.
"You're about to go from being an international hero to a bum, overnight. I hope you've carefully considered all the ramifications of your decision."
Chapter 55 The Voice of Michael. General O'Toole spent the afternoon in his room, watching on the video monitor as Taburi and Yamanaka checked out the nuclear weapons. He was excused on the basis of his presumed stomach upset, from his assigned task of checking out the weapon subsystems. The procedure was surprisingly straightforward. No one would have suspected that the cosmonauts were initiating an activity designed to destroy the most impressive work of engineering ever seen by humans. Before dinner, O'Toole placed a call to his wife. The Newton was rapidly approaching the Earth now, and the delay time between transmission and reception was under 3 minutes. Old-fashioned two-way conversations were even possible. His talk with Kathleen was cordial and mundane. General O'Toole thought briefly about sharing his moral dilemma with his wife, but he realized that the videophone was not secure and decided against it. They both expressed excitement about being reunited again in the very near future. The general ate dinner with the crew. Janos was in one of his boisterous moods, entertaining the others with stories about his afternoon with the bullets, as he insisted on calling the nuclear bombs.
"At one point," Janos said to Francesca,
who had been laughing non-stop since his narrative began,
"we had all the bullets lightly anchored to the floor and lined up in a row, like dominoes. I scared the shit out of Yamanaka. I pushed the front one over, and they all fell, clang, bang, in every direction. Hiro was certain they were going to explode."
"Weren't you worried that you might injure some critical components?" David Brown asked.
"Nope,"
Janos replied. "The manuals that Otto gave me said that you couldn't hurt those things if you dropped them from the top of the Trump Tower. Besides," he added, "they aren't even armed yet. Right, Herr Admiral?" Heilmann nodded, and Janos launched into another story. General O'Toole drifted away into his own mind, struggling impossibly with the relationship between those metal objects in the military ship and the mushroom-shaped cloud in the Pacific. Francesca interrupted his reverie.
"You have an urgent call on your private line, Michael," she said. "President Bothwell will be on in 5 minutes."
The conversation at the table stopped.
"Well," said Janos with a grin, "you must be some special person.
It's not just everybody that receives a call from Slugger Bothwell."
General O'Toole excused himself politely from the table and went to his room. "He must know," he was thinking, as he waited impatiently for the call to connect. "But of course, he's the President of the United States." O'Toole had always been a baseball fan, and his favorite team, naturally enough, was the Boston Red Sox. Baseball had gone into receivership at the height of the Great Chaos, in 2141, but a new group of owners had put the leagues back in business 4 years later. When Michael was six, in 2148, his father had taken him to Fenway Dome to watch a game between the Red Sox and the Havana Hurricanes. It was the beginning of a lifelong love affair for O'Toole. Sherman Bothwell had been a left-handed, power-hitting first baseman for the Red Sox between 2172 and 2187. He had been immensely popular. A Missouri boy by birth, his genuine modesty and old-fashioned dedication to hard work were as exceptional as the 527 home runs he had hit during his 16 years in the major leagues. During the last year of his baseball career, Bothwell's wife had died in a terrible boating accident. Sherman's uncomplaining courage in facing the responsibility of raising his children as a single parent was applauded in every American home. 3 years later, when he married Linda Black, the darling daughter of the governor of Texas, it was obvious to many people that old Sherman had a political career in mind. He advanced through the ranks with great speed. First lieutenant governor, then governor, and presidential hopeful. He was elected to the White House by a landslide in 2196. It was anticipated that he would soundly defeat the Christian conservative candidate in the forthcoming general election of 2200.
"Hello, General O'Toole," the man in the blue suit with the friendly smile said when the screen was no longer blank. "This is Sherman Bothwell, your president."
The president was using no notes. He was leaning forward in a simple chair, his elbows resting on his thighs and his hands folded in front of him. He was talking as if he were sitting beside General O'Toole in someone's cozy living room.
"I have been following your Newton mission with great interest, as has everybody in my family, including Linda and the four kids, ever since you launched. But I have been especially attentive these last several weeks as the tragedies have rained down upon you and your courageous colleagues. My, my. Who would have ever thought that such a thing as that Rama ship could exist? It is truly staggering. Anyway, I understand from our COG representatives that the order has been given to destroy Rama. Now,
I know that decisions like that are not made lightly, and that it places quite a large responsibility on folks like yourself. Nevertheless, I'm certain it's the right action. Yes, sirree, I know it's correct. Why, you know, my daughter Courtney, that's the 8-year-old, she wakes up with nightmares almost every night. We were watching when you were all trying to capture that bayat, the one that looked like a crab, and my, it was positively awful. Now, Courtney knows, it's been all over the television, that Rama is heading directly for the Earth, and she is really scared. Terrified. She thinks the whole country will be overrun by those crab things, and that she and all her friends will be chopped up just like Journalist Wilson. I'm telling you this, General, because I know you're facing a big decision. And I've heard on the grapevine that you may be hesitant to destroy that humongous spacecraft and all its wonders. But, General, I've told Courtney about you. I've told her that you and your crew are going to blow Rama to smithereens long before it reaches the Earth. That's why I called. To tell you that I'm counting on you. And so is Courtney.
General O'Toole had thought, before listening to the President, that he might take advantage of the call and lay his dilemma in front of the leader of the American people. He had imagined that he might even question Slugger Bothwell about the nature of a species that destroys to protect against an unlikely downside.